finger here.
And we'll bring him here. Let's not try and pass these out today because we've got a guest speaker.
Okay.
But if you could bring a box next time,
I will.
Okay.
I will get to
focus. Okay, great. Okay, I'd like to go ahead and get started if we can this morning. We have a very special start to class today. I have invited a guest speaker from Baylor College of Medicine to come and talk, Dr. Bob Parkerson. He is the co-director of the International Health Track for medical students at Baylor. He's been very crucial in establishing a WHO collaborating center for family and community medicine. And he's been a mentor in a program called Shoulder to Shoulder, which has functioned to begin to provide medical services to a rural village in Honduras. And so he's going to share some of his experiences with the Shoulder to Shoulder program today. He's going to talk, I think, for about 15 minutes and then open it up for your questions. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Dr. Parkerson.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Good morning. It's a pleasure for me to get to be with you this morning, and I have to tell you, it's a little bit different for me because usually I'm in the hospital setting, seeing patients and teaching medical students and residents. So to have to lecture to a class is a new one on me. So I appreciate your interest this morning, and I want to tell you a bit about the Shoulder to Shoulder Foundation, because it may be something that you guys at some point during your time at Rice want to get involved with. We are in big need of help from people from all backgrounds, but particularly in engineering and science. And so I want to let you hear about the experience, and then I want you to think further about whether that's something that you may want to get involved with sometime during your time at Rice. A few years ago, we were looking for a place that Baylor medical students and residents could get an ongoing experience in a poor area of the world, in an isolated area of the world, to see what health was like and what life was like for people. And we looked about in different places in Central and South America. But friends of ours at the University of Cincinnati already had a program in rural Honduras that they had going for their medical students, and they invited us to come down. And I had been looking in cities and so forth, and this friend of mine says, well, you know, it's only a short bus ride out in the country, so why don't you come out and look at our program? So I got in this bus, and 9 hours later, we were at this place. So he sort of hoodwinked me into this, but we've been into this ever since. We had no intention of doing real grassroots rural health care, but that's what we've gotten into, and it's been a wonderful experience for all of us that have been involved. This is the little town of Santa Ana. This is it. This is the main city center, a little Catholic church in the middle of town. As it stands right now, twice a year we take groups of Baylor medical students and faculty and residents and go down and spend 2 weeks in Santa Ana. I was telling Dr. Richards Cordham that we've actually got other schools involved, and we're thrilled that perhaps there's a chance for Rice students to be involved. The University of Houston School of Optometry goes with us now, and we're looking for a dental partner as well. But twice a year, we take groups of students down. This is one of our groups of students, and we go down and do primary health care and public health type work for 2 weeks at a time. You notice the woman on the right is in a wheelchair. There's a young man in town, like so many local folks in Central and South America. This young man was trying to come to the United States to do work, to send money back to his family, and he got caught. He was hitching a freight train across Mexico and got caught up under the train, got double amputee. And anyway, he's the barber in this little town. He needed a wheelchair. So the Methodist Hospital fixed a wheelchair up for us, but the airlines was going to charge $200 to get it down there, so one of our students developed an acute neurologic problem. It's a very first world flight down from Houston to San Pedro Sula or Tegucigalpa, Continental, but when you get there, we get into sort of a more third world type transport, and go up in the mountains. Again, it's about a 7 or 8 hour trip, so it's a bit of a schlep up there, but it's beautiful, and we have big fun. We cut up, and it's a good adventure for everybody. There is a nearby larger town called Comancagua that does have. I was telling Rebecca that when we first went there, there was no electricity, no telephone. The running water resources were very limited. In this larger town, there was electricity. There's a bus transport that we take into that town. But then the roads get so bad that you can't get a bus down to where we go to Santa Ana. So we get in the back of pickup trucks to go down to our final destination. And this is a little town of about 700 people. This is where we're based. But the rural catchment area of people who come into this project is probably, it's about 13 or 14 villages, and it's probably about 10,000 people altogether that we're trying to serve. This was the young man that needed the wheelchair. Transportation is a big problem. You know, the roads are a problem. The trucks are not that plentiful, but most people can't afford even to pay the fee to ride in a truck. So most folks come on foot or on muleback. The way we've set this up, we basically first met with the leadership in the town and to try to figure out if they were interested in aligning with us. And if you can just put yourself in their circumstance, if you can imagine being a rural villager in Honduras and not really having much access to the outside world, and then all of a sudden this group of, you know, 6 or 8 Americans come and appear on your doorstep and say they want to try to help you with health care. The folks here looked at us like we were from out of space when we first came there. Like, what in the world is your agenda, you know? But quickly they warmed up to us and became interested in trying to work together. And this small group of rural people who really are not educated beyond about the sixth grade level, within a few months they came up with a 10-year strategic plan about what they wanted to do to try to help their own healthcare circumstance. And we've really tried to follow their plan, essentially. These are some of the leaders in that healthcare committee. The lady in the green shirt is Clementina Sanchez, who's the president of their healthcare committee. The Ministry of Health in Honduras is very poor, and the only infrastructure existing really is a small Ministry of Health clinic that's run by an LVN level nurse, and that's the lady in the white shirt, Sonia Cuello. And she does a great job at vaccination and antenatal care and that sort of thing. But they really need help in terms of diagnostic and curative health care, and they need big help in terms of public health, other public health type issues. Angel Diaz is the man in the light green shirt. He's one of the members of the health committee. The lady in the purple shirt is a woman who's a nurse midwife tutor from Pennsylvania, and she and her husband, he's a family doctor, they come down with us often, and she does a lot of continuing medical education work with the traditional birth attendants. All the deliveries in the rural area are done by granny midwives or traditional birth attendants. These are uneducated women who learn from other midwives about how to do deliveries. And I was telling Rebecca that the thing that we've been so impressed with is what a great job these women do. They all feel a real calling about what they do. They're not educated, but they are educated. They learn about what's worked in rural Honduras from other midwives, and they are totally dedicated to what they're doing. They do a wonderful job. Their main problem, though, is if somebody needs a C-section, if they can't deliver normally, the nearest hospital is 5 hours away on a bumpy back road. So it's a real problem in terms of technology. And we hope to help them with this eventually. The only real existing municipal building right now is a primary school. So they close down school for us when we go down there, and we stay in the primary school and have our clinics out of the primary school. So this is just getting set up, a couple of the medical students. They actually built a little community building in the town to have a place for us to have our meals and so forth, and then they, of course, use that as for other events during the year. This is just inside that community building during one of our meals. This has been, as I said, it's been a great experience for Baylor students, and now we've been doing this for 4 or 5 years. This guy on the end here eating is it was a fourth year student when he went down. He just finished his neurology fellowship at Baylor and is now the chief of neurology at Bentov Hospital. So And I was just I saw a guy who had been down, who's now an ophthalmologist, who's now graduated and in practice, and is now continuing to go down to Honduras to do eye surgery down there. So we're into a generation now of medical students now graduated who've been down. Fairly basic. We stay in the school. We use the school latrines. We actually now have some little cold water shower set up on the end of the school building, but it's pretty basic. So if you do go with us, you got to realize that we're roughing it a little bit. Eventually, we hope to have a dormitory. We're building, in the middle of building a medical clinic there, that we hope to have a full-time Honduran doctor there, and we'll have a small dormitory for people to stay in. So we hope that even though we're just going 2 weeks at a time, twice a year now, that in the future we can have people going down at different times of the year and staying in this little dormitory. When we go, we bring our own supplies. Each person brings a suitcase of their stuff and a suitcase of medical supplies. We get donated medicines and other things that we need to take down with us, and set up a pharmacy in one of the school classrooms. And as I mentioned, when we first went there, we didn't have electricity, but they've been working on getting this little town electrified for the last 7 or 8 years, and finally last year did get electricity, excuse me, down there, and so now we have the wherewithal to do lab. It's very limited so far, but once we get the clinic built, we'll have many opportunities for developing the technology there. This is sort of our makeshift lab in the meantime. So people come 2 or 3 hours walk in to see the doctors here. Again, this is about 13 or 14 villages that have access to this area. And the way we've got it set up, the Baylor students are the primary providers. So they see the patient first, much as they might at Bentob or at one of the private hospitals. And they go through the history and physical and make their own decisions, make their own assessment and plan about what they would do. And then they go precept that patient with a faculty preceptor who thinks through the case with them. And then the faculty goes back and examines the patient and they make a final plan. But it's a great experience for the Baylor students to sort of be more in the driver's seat as well. We actually have students and residents from lots of different places. This last time we had 2 students from Johns Hopkins. The time before that we had students from California and from University of Alabama. A lot of the folks from Cincinnati, we send people to their site and they send people to our site. Again, people have a hard time getting in. This is what we call the bambalancia. That's a bamboo poles with a quilt draped for somebody who wasn't able to walk in themselves. Thankfully, that guy wasn't able to walk in only because he was inebriated. He'd gotten in a machete fight with another man, and so we're stitching him up there. A lot of what we do is related to children. Big problem with malnutrition in the city. It's not frank protein energy malnutrition like kwashiorkor or marasmus, but it's just micronutrient deficiency, stunting and anemia and that sort of thing. This is a case of kwashiorkor. It's a more severe form of malnutrition, but it's an odd thing to see there. This was a child in a large SIB ship, sort of in the middle, and somehow was being ignored within the family. Ended up with kwashiorkor. We see most of what we see is primary care sort of stuff. You know, the things you would see in a primary care office here: gastroenteritis, respiratory illnesses, skin infections, diseases related to reproduction and pregnancy, and so forth. Trauma. But we do see things that are more advanced because people don't have access to health care. So here's a lady with a large gout or a large problem with her thyroid gland. One of the big needs we have is for eye care. And again, the University of Houston School of Optometry is now going down with us each trip. And these are just some of the students from the optometry school with us as well. So we've got real needs right now, and we're in the sort of brink of developing all this. We have needs for technological assistance for optometry, for dentistry, for basic medical care, and then just for the basic sort of public health issues that we're working on as well. Just getting a pair of glasses. This kid has never been able to see right, but just getting a pair of glasses is like opening up a whole new world for him. And ultimately, he needs eye surgery, which we can't offer yet. Dentistry. This is a local dentist from this larger nearby town. She works for the Ministry of Health, and she's coming out there about one day every other week. But as when we go down, we try to bring dental teams when we can. When we finish this clinic, we hope to have a more developed dental suite. One of the fun things for the medical students is the kids. So after hours, there's a lot of fun stuff that goes on. This is one of the students doing origami. I mentioned to you the Indigenous midwives, but this is the continuing medical educational event with the local midwives, and this is Candace Kugel, who's this nurse midwife from Pennsylvania. We've always done this in the local level, so there are maybe 10-15 midwives coming in to get education every time we go. This last time we had a regional meeting at a larger town and had about 55 midwives who came to that event. And they focused on HIV, how HIV is transmitted, what the problems of HIV and pregnancy are, and that sort of thing. Prevention. We do a lot of work with the school children. We've got three types of nutrition programs going right now. One is for early childhood supplemental feedings. One is the school lunch program in the primary school. And then the other is just sort of a community project producing tilapia. We have a series of tilapia ponds. We need technologic help with that. We can't make the tilapia pond run correctly. So there's a lot of different levels that someone could get involved with. The student group here, the student group at Baylor, for example, has a hunger lunch program where they every month have a lunch that they sponsor, and the proceeds from that lunch go to help the nutrition project in Santa Ana. Student group here could get involved with something like that, and it's just a lot of we need help right now with the school lunch program, for example. This is the school lunch program. Some of the foods are from UNICEF, but they weren't adequate, so we're trying to help them supplement that food and get organization going. The moms actually cook in the moms of the school children rotate the cooking responsibility and so forth. These are the tilapia ponds that we need help with. A lot of what we do is public health type work, and in the afternoons, a crew of people stay back and see patients, but a crew goes out to make village visits to these other rural villages to try to do outreach work. There are always people who are invalid and can't walk into the clinic where we are, and we want to do public health talks and so forth. So this is a group going out to other villages. This is kind of standard housing. People cook inside the house. Just a typical public health type problem. They cook inside the house. You can see there's plenty of cracks in the walls and so forth for air to exchange, but they have no venting of their oven that they cook on. So all the smoke just permeates out in the environment in the house and out through the walls. So people have a lot of chronic lung disease just from smoke inhalation. Be a simple thing just to vent the pipe, have a vent pipe for the stove, but it's just the economics in getting something like that to catch on. These are different public health projects that we need to do. Home visit on an elderly lady. Someone who's had a bad stroke and is invalid. It's Nancy Weller, who's a faculty person in our department, who's a health education specialist, and she's given a public health talk on just basic hygiene and public health issues. A similar talk in a church. Water resources. There's a very basic system for water supply for that little town. It's a lot of the towns have this sort of similar thing. It's been set up maybe 15 years ago by the Catholic Relief Society, but it's basically they find springs at the top of mountains and build a cistern there, and then have a series of pipes that come down the town there's a lot of problems about upkeep. Here's a break in the line where junk's getting in the line. Chlorination doesn't happen in any scientific way. So there's a real problem in terms of getting proper potable water supply. Likewise, is random wastewater disposal. This is a wastewater from a home that's going right down into the river where a lot of other people get their water from. So it's lots and lots to be done in terms of public health, sanitation issues, random dumping of garbage. I mentioned that we're trying to build a clinic there to have a full-time Honduran doctor. So the town has actually raised all the money to buy the land for the clinic. They found the land, they bought it, they've got that going, and then we're trying to help them with getting this constructed. This was the opening ceremony for the groundbreaking for the clinic, putting in the foundation. And at this point, we've already got the walls up, and we're this is now the dry season, so we're going to be putting the roof on the clinic during this dry season. And we hope to have a full-time doctor down there, as I mentioned, to bring more continuous health care to these folks. So at the end of the journey, they have a day for us, and then we get back in the trucks and head back. And most of the students take a few days at the end to go to the beach. They've got incredible snorkeling and scuba and so forth as well. So that just gives you a little overview of our program, and we'd be delighted to have you guys involved with it in any way you want to be, and the opportunities for technologic development there and appropriate technology are pretty broad. Yes, ma'am. I would say, respiratory stuff, pneumonia, just URIs like I have, pneumonias, skin infections, gastroenteritis, diarrhea, that sort of thing, problems with sexually transmitted diseases, and then, more subtle issues are the malnutrition issues that we talked about. That's not perceived as a problem so much, but it is a problem in terms of stunting and perhaps having kids not have their full intellectual potential and so forth. Yes? Great question. I don't know. Here and there. Basically, it's a struggle. And it's a struggle even to make it happen for faculty and students. We've got to have faculty get down there, have their salaries continue, a way to have residents go, a way to have students go. The whole cost of the trip is around $1,200 per individual, and we've been able to scrape up money to try to help students with part of their cost, but the student really bears the brunt of their cost. We've been able to work it out within our own budgeting system to have faculty salaries continue at this point and have travel expenses for faculty covered. In terms of just the expense of building a clinic down there and all, Baylor has allowed us to form a nonprofit organization. So we've gone out to different civic groups and church groups and so forth to try to do fundraising for this. The Baylor students have a charity ball every year. Well, they've allowed us to be recipients the last 2 years for their charity ball. So different things like that.
Yeah. You mentioned as far as like infectious disease, STDs. Are there other issues, or is it so isolated? Cholera, tuberculosis, malaria, anything like that?
Great questions. Well, cholera has not been a problem so much there. I mean, cholera, as you probably know, can go in waves through the world, and it's a problem where there's crowding and where there's poor sanitation and water and wastewater disposal and sewage disposal. There, it's not crowded because it's not an urban area, and at least right now, most people have got this fairly reasonable water coverage and pit latrined in their house. There's not complete coverage, about 60 or 70%. So they've not had a problem recently. Tuberculosis is an endemic problem. Malaria is not such a great problem right there, and I'm not totally sure why that is. It's just in terms of mosquito, you know, proper mosquito transmission. It's only about 700 feet sea level, even though we go up in the mountains, we come down. So mosquitoes should be able to live there, but it's just not a real problem. Epidemics of dengue are a problem, which, as you know, is another mosquito-borne type illness. Yes, yes, ma'am. Well, it's a great question. There are herbalists in that sort of local traditional medicine, and I'll tell you the truth, I don't know a whole lot about that in the area. I mean, that's something that we ought to explore, and it may be a good student project to try to look into that. I used to practice in rural Africa in Zimbabwe, and you know, the whole traditional healer thing there is very well developed. The Nyanga is a traditional healer, and that those people are viewed in different ways, but the way we viewed them is that they did a lot of good for people, and that it was important for us to work with them and try to help them understand what we did, and for us to understand what they did. We've not found an analogous person in rural Honduras, but I know that there are traditional remedies that exist. I'm not sure they're actually sort of doctors of those around the communities. Thank you so much.
Okay. I think this room will be loud enough.
I wanted to get started with a couple of topics that have recently been in the news regarding bioengineering. Many of you may have seen an interesting story that broke in the last week. You'll remember we talked about Dr. Bezwada and the study results that he faked as part of the attempt to treat advanced breast cancer with high-dose chemotherapy. Well, just a week ago, there was an article in the magazine called The Scientist about a study which was published, I believe, in June of 2005. And the article that broke last week was that all of the patient data that was described in this study was actually faked by the lead author on the study. So I'm going to go first to, oops, I thought I was going to go, oh, what happened here? I was going to go to the abstract for the study, there we go, now we can get there. This was a study that was looking at non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs as a way to reduce the risk of developing oral cancer. And it was published in a journal called The Lancet, which is a very, very prestigious medical journal. It's very difficult to get a paper accepted in The Lancet, and papers that are published there have very high visibility. So this was a paper that was published there. You can see here's the lead author, Dr. Sudbo, who's at a hospital in Norway. And he is the person who actually has admitted fabricating the data for 900 patients that were reported in this article. But a couple of the co-authors on this study, Dr. Lippmann, for example, are actually on the faculty at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. And so it's unclear what was the involvement, whether the other authors had any knowledge of what happened, whether they failed to follow up on their responsibility to look at the integrity of the data that you have when you're a co-author on the paper. The main point that I wanted to make is that scientific ethics that can affect patients, it doesn't just happen in the past. It happens all the time, and it's something that as a field we need to continually be aware of. So that's one thing that was in the news. Another thing that's been in the news recently, here we go, is you may have heard a story on NPR, this was a couple of days ago, about a couple of drug companies that were collaborating together. Each of them had patents covering a different medicine that's used to treat HIV. We learned about highly active antiretroviral therapy, where patients take combinations typically of three drugs. So sometimes different drug companies will hold the patents for those drugs, and so patients who are taking HART end up taking sometimes as many as 20 to 30 pills a day. This is an example of a new both business development and technology development where these two drug companies are collaborating to make a single pill that can be used as part of HART. And then there was an interesting development in the packaging of malaria drugs. When Matt McCurdy was here and was talking to us about malaria, he mentioned there was one bullet on his slide about packaging malaria drugs as a way to have a very simple technology that could improve the treatment for malaria. We don't have time to listen to all three of these stories, so I was going to let you pick which one you'd like to hear. So raise your hand if you'd like to hear the Lancet study faked story. Okay. How about the single pill for HIV? Okay, and how about the packaging malaria drugs? Okay, I think the middle one is the winner. So we'll hear about the single pill for HIV, but the links are here for all of them if you're interested. They're all very interesting stories. This is working. Not looking good. Let me try one more time.
Support for NPR comes from AT&T. AT&T's Packing to Invent and SDT Drive to Deliver. Introducing the new AT&T, your world of delivery.
Two drug companies have set aside commercial rivalry to create the first single once-a-day pill to help manage HIV and AIDS. The new pill combines Receiva, made by Bristol Myers Squibb, with Viria and Entriva, drugs made by Gilead Sciences, Incorporated. Almost 20% of new HIV patients take that combination. A study published today in the New England Journal of Medicine says the single pill was more effective and had fewer side effects than other multiple pill combinations commonly used to treat AIDS and HIV. The new drug does not yet have a name or government approval. Dr. Norbert Bischofberger is Executive Vice President for Research and Development at Gilead Sciences. He says the single pill is a big step forward.
That's always been the holy grail, and when you talk to actual patients, they let us know along the way that it's just not possible for a chronic, long-term treatable disease to comply with these complicated regimens.
How complicated are those?
Well, I can only talk for myself. I had to take antibiotics the number of times in my life. These were 3 times per day for 5 days. And almost inadvertently, every time I had to do that, there was one point in a day where I realized I had forgotten to take my medication in the right time. And for HIV, that's an absolute no-no. If you don't comply with your regimen, then that will lead inadvertently to failures and to drug resistance. So it's a big problem.
And is it assumed that all the patients who currently take this combination of Susceva, Viria, and Entriva will be able to take this new pill?
No, I mean, the medications are never for everybody. There will always be people that can't tolerate it, people for whom this medication is not particularly the most optimal ones. But there are other combinations available that those patients could take. But as our study has shown, a large part of patients can take this regimen and respond very, very favorably.
And for those who are taking multiple pill combinations, all those pills carry a very hefty price tag, sometimes costing as much as $30,000 a year. How much will this new pill cost?
Well, we have not decided on pricing yet, but we launched about a year ago a combination product, Truvada, which contains both Viria and Entriva, and the price of the combination product was the same as the two individual components.
Should we assume that this is likely to happen in this case as well?
That's certainly a reasonable assumption.
Doctor, why haven't companies done this before, joined forces?
Well, there is always a believe in both organizations that this is the right thing to do for the patient.
But why now? Was there an event or something that happened that brought the two companies together?
Well, first of all, if you want to co-formulate three different drugs, those three different drugs have to be compatible in the sense that all of them are given once a day and all of them can be given without regards to food. And those three drugs became available really about 2 years ago, and it was at that point that the two companies came together.
Now, this combination of these three drugs is one of the most commonly prescribed to treat HIV, but it's just one of many regimens. Is it possible that this will lead other companies to join forces, other companies to do much the same thing?
Yes, I am absolutely convinced that this will be the start of a future trend that the companies will more and more collaborate to co-formulate their respective drugs into one convenient co-formulated app. I do believe that will be the case.
Dr. Bischofberger, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, so he talked about two important aspects of the science. He talked about the possibility that resistance can develop when HIV patients miss a dose of their drug. That's one of the reasons why it's so crucial to comply with those regimens. And he talked about the ability to formulate the drugs together into a single pill. Those are really the two crucial scientific needs that this new pill has to satisfy. The rest of it really is political aspects and business aspects, but they're all important in terms of making this available to patients. Okay. So last time we talked about the leading causes of death for people aged 15 to 44 in developing and developed countries. What I want to do today is we're going to finish up looking at the age group between 45 and 59 and compare the leading causes of death in developed and developing countries. And then in the last few minutes, I want to talk about a program called Global Health Challenges. So if we look at the leading causes of mortality in this age group, it's interesting because here we're actually going to see less of a difference between developing and developed countries. If we look at the developing world, the leading causes of death in this age group are cardiovascular disease, cancer, unintentional injuries, and HIV and AIDS. If we compare that now to developed countries, you see that cardiovascular disease and cancer are the two leading causes of death, followed by unintentional injury. So for the three leading causes of death in this age group, they're actually the same in developed and developing countries. In developed countries, the fourth leading cause of death is digestive diseases, and as we'll see, the most common of those is cirrhosis of the liver. We talked about ischemic heart disease last time. The two most common cardiovascular diseases that lead to death are ischemic heart disease and cerebrovascular disease. Remember, in ischemic heart disease, what happens is we have an atherosclerotic plaque that builds up in the coronary artery, builds up slowly over time. Some fraction of those atherosclerotic plaques are what are known as unstable plaques, where you can get the fibrous covering fractures. That exposes the material that's in the middle of the plaque to the blood supply in the bloodstream. When the blood is exposed to that material in the middle of the plaque, you can very quickly get a blood clot. When that blood clot forms, now there's no more supply of oxygenated blood going to the heart muscle that was formerly supplied by that coronary artery, and so we have a heart attack. We talked about two treatments, and we'll come back to this in our third unit in much, much more detail. We talked about two treatments to treat coronary artery disease. One of them is known by the acronym CABBAGE. CABBAGE stands for coronary artery bypass graft. What that means for most patients is that you have to have open heart surgery. So they're going to saw through the sternum and open the pericardial sac, which contains the heart, and then they're going to sew a graft that's going to go from the aorta and then connects downstream of the blockage in the coronary artery. So we make this bypass around the blockage. The other treatment that we'll take a look at in some detail is known by the acronym of PTCA, which stands for percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty. It's also known as balloon angioplasty. In balloon angioplasty, instead of doing open heart surgery and sewing a bypass around the blockage, what we're going to do is we're going to insert a tiny catheter that has a balloon at the tip of the catheter, and we're going to advance that balloon-tipped catheter to the point where the blockage exists. When we get there, then we're going to blow up the balloon and basically smash the plaque out of the way, dilate the vessel, and then we're going to remove the balloon, and so we've opened up the lumen of the artery. And so we'll compare some of the advantages and disadvantages of these two techniques when we get to Unit 3 and look at how technologies can solve problems in health. The other type of cardiovascular disease that we just touched on briefly was stroke. And when a stroke occurs, basically patients very abruptly will experience a focal neurologic deficit. They may wake up with a completed stroke where they have partial paralysis or inability to speak, for example. In some patients, the stroke is preceded by what are called transient ischemic attacks. They'll have some warning signs beforehand, but that only happens in 5 to 20% of patients. So many times what happens is patients will wake up with a completed stroke. What happens in a stroke is that we're going to have a blockage in a blood vessel that supplies the brain with oxygenated blood. This can occur as a result of atherosclerosis there, and so we're going to get a blockage that suddenly clots off in a blood vessel that supplies the brain. Or we can have a clot form in another artery. A little piece of it can break off and travel through the blood supply, lodge in the brain, and block an artery there. And so basically, we have the same thing that happens in the heart happen in the brain. Now, the cells in the brain that depend on this artery to supply oxygenated blood no longer have that supply of oxygen that they need, and those cells can die as a result. So we can get thrombosis, a clot in the vessel. An embolism is what happens when you have a clot that forms somewhere else. It breaks off and then lodges in a blood vessel in the brain. This can be treated. I'm going to skip through this. This can be treated using thrombolytic agents to dissolve that clot that's present in the blood vessel in the brain. One of the risks of treating a stroke with a thrombolytic agent is that when you thin the blood, then if you have a small tear in a blood vessel in the brain, you can get bleeding out of that blood vessel, and you can have what's known as a hemorrhagic stroke. And that's what happened to Prime Minister Sharon. He had a hemorrhagic stroke. And so he had previously had a thrombolytic stroke, and so he was being treated with blood thinners. And it's a very fine line to sort of titrate how much you want to suppress those clotting mechanisms, because if you don't get it right, then you can have bleeding into the brain and a hemorrhagic stroke can result. Some experimental therapies. Angioplasty is an experimental therapy that's being looked at to treat stroke. And here's an example of an angiogram in the brain. So we've injected now radio-opaque dye so that we can look at the absorption of that dye as it flows through the blood vessels. Here's the blockage before thrombolytic treatment, and here now is after thrombolytic treatment. And the most important thing in terms of patients having a good outcome is that this therapy be started as soon as possible. Remember in that video that we looked at about motorcycle helmets when the doctor said a brain injury is forever? So a stroke basically does the same thing. Once you injure those cells and they die, they don't ever come back. And so really our only approaches are to try and dissolve the clot Or if we're not able to do that in time, then the only approach that we have is rehabilitative approaches to help patients and their families cope with the outcomes that the patients experience as a result of their stroke. Okay. Any questions about cardiovascular disease, in the back? About 30 minutes. 30 minutes to an hour. The first hour really is the most important.
What causes arteries to clog in the heart rather than the brain?
So we don't fully understand all of the risk factors that lead to atherosclerosis and understand the pattern of which vessels it develops in. Some of the things that seem to be important are if you have bifurcations, branches in the artery, those are areas where the blood flow at those points is more turbulent, and that seems to be more likely to injure the endothelial cells that line the surface of the blood vessel. So if those cells get injured a little bit, then you can get cholesterol deposits that go underneath those endothelial cells. Then you get this inflammatory reaction that can lead to that cascade of atherosclerosis. We know that high blood pressure is a risk factor, again, predominantly because it's going to increase the trauma to those endothelial cells, and then high serum cholesterol level and high serum nicotine level. But just in terms of, you know, thinking about, are you more at risk in your coronary arteries? Are you more at risk in your peripheral vessels? Are you more at risk in your cerebral arteries? We don't really have a good understanding to predict for, you know, patient A versus patient B, which they'll be more at risk for. Any other questions? I want to move on to cancer then. We're going to talk about cancer in general terms first, and then I want to talk about lung cancer, which is the leading cause of cancer death for people in this age group. So in this age group, every year, cancer kills about 1.5 million people worldwide every year. As I said, lung cancer is the leading killer for people in this age group. More than 250,000 people die every year as a result of lung cancer. Second leading killer is stomach cancer. Behind that, we have liver cancer and then breast cancer. So these are ranked in this age group. So cancer is a group of diseases. All of them are characterized basically by uncontrolled cell growth and by loss of differentiation of cells. Most cancers are characterized by the formation of a tumor, which is an abnormal mass that's going to form somewhere. Now, leukemias are the one exception to that, where we have circulating cancer cells in the bloodstream. But most cancers are characterized by the formation of a tumor. So a tumor is nothing more than an abnormal mass of tissue. It's going to grow more rapidly than the surrounding normal tissue, and it doesn't serve any physiologic purpose. It's basically going to prey on the host and take resources away from surrounding normal tissues. Two types of tumors, benign tumors and malignant tumors. And the difference between the two is that malignant tumors have the capability to metastasize, and metastasis really is what causes death from cancer. Benign tumors do not have the ability to metastasize. Generally speaking, benign tumors are not life-threatening. They can be treated with surgical removal, but with malignant tumors, we have the risk of metastasis, and that can lead to death. If we look at the microscopic appearance of a tumor, what I'm going to show you here is if we were to take a biopsy from the inside of your cheek. The inside of your cheek is lined by layers of epithelial cells, and that epithelium is roughly about 0.5 millimeter thick. Okay? And if we look at cancers, about 85% of cancers originate in an epithelial lining. So the skin, the lining of the GI tract, the lining of the reproductive tract, the lining of the urinary tract, all of those epithelial coverings are at risk for the development of a tumor. So if we look at those cells that line that tissue, what you see is as you go from the surface down to the bottom of the epithelium, is you see that the cells look different at the top than they do at the bottom. These little purple dots, those represent the nuclei within those cells. And if you look at the cells at the top, the nuclei are tiny. If you look at the cells at the bottom, the nuclei are quite large. They fill up almost the entire cell. These cells at the surface, they're what is called terminally differentiated. Those are cells that have differentiated, and many of these cells at the surface may in fact be dead cells that you will just slough off naturally. So this epithelium is going to renew itself over time. And it's the cells at the bottom of the epithelium that are responsible for that renewal. Those are the cells that are actively dividing. And so they're going to send a population of daughter cells that will regenerate this epithelium. So these less differentiated cells are characterized by a large nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio. This is what the normal oral cavity epithelium looks like. Underneath the epithelium, you have collagen fibers. That's going to give the tissue its strength. You have some elastin fibers, which will give the tissue a little bit of elasticity. And you have blood vessels. Those blood vessels are going to supply enough oxygen to the cells down here at the bottom of the epithelium. These guys get their oxygen via just diffusion from the air. Okay? This is what happens when you have an oral cancer. Over here, we've got epithelium and we've got stroma underneath. Now, if you look at, if you compare this epithelium to that epithelium, you can see that throughout, we've got pretty large nuclei in those cells. That's actually a precancerous condition. And so people who smoke, who chew tobacco, who consume a lot of alcohol, those are all risk factors that can lead to the development of this precancerous condition. What can happen when a precancer develops is that these cells develop the ability to invade beneath the epithelium. And then you get something that looks like this. So you get a disorganized mess of tumor cells, stroma, blood vessels. Doesn't have that characteristic organization that normal tissue has anymore. And so this is a cancer within the oral cavity. And this is an example of a malignant cancer. This tumor has the ability to metastasize. And most frequently in the oral cavity, it will metastasize by tumor cells invading into these blood vessels and traveling to distant sites via the bloodstream. Okay, so if we look at, in the United States, cancers that cause a lot of death, we see both for men and for women, lung cancer is the leading cause. Okay, if we look in men, the second leading cause is prostate cancer. In women, it's breast cancer. Third leading cause for both is colorectal cancer. In men, fourth is pancreas. In women, the fourth is ovarian cancer. And we'll do a unit on ovarian cancer later when we talk about important technologies to address early detection of cancer. Okay. So the difference between a benign tumor and a malignant tumor really lies and the potential of those cancer cells to be able to invade and spread. And it's really the degree of differentiation, and it's the lack of differentiation that characterizes those tumor cells that have the ability to invade other tissues. And so some of the hallmarks of those cells that have the ability to invade are that both the cells and the nuclei, normally in normal tissue, they all have very similar size and shape. In a malignant tumor, you've just got a wide range of sizes and shapes. They're not round anymore. They can be sort of spindly shaped. The cells will have multiple copies of the chromosomes. They'll have extra DNA, very large nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio, and you'll see a large number of cells that are actively dividing. You'll see a large number of mitotic cells. And then we talked about precancerous conditions as well. So when a cancer arises, that process is known as carcinogenesis. And carcinogenesis basically is just the result of genetic changes that don't kill the cells. So it's non-lethal genetic damage that can accumulate over time. And what we find when we look at a tumor is that a tumor mass can arise from the division of a single cell. And that's what we mean by the clonal expansion of a single cell. So we can get one cell that has incurred this genetic damage, and then it's going to divide in a way that doesn't respond to any of the body's controls to say stop dividing. And as a result, we're going to get this tumor. So when we look at the development of a cancer, for most cancers, it develops in four stages. We have this malignant transformation in our target cell. Then our target cell is going to divide, and we're going to get a mass that develops in the local organ site where that single target cell had its origin. Then we get local invasion. So we get local invasion into the organ where the tumor arose, and then we get distant metastases forming. And I like this cartoon because it shows that whole process starting from our single transformed cell. We get then the expansion of that to form a tumor mass. Then we get invasion into the organ site where it originated. And then we get spread either through the blood vessels or through the lymphatics. So the tumor cells crawl into the blood vessels. They make these little microemboli of tumor cells, and then they can crawl out into other organ sites where they continue to grow. Metastasis, as I said, is responsible for the vast majority of cancer death. More than 90% of cancer death is a result of metastasis. And the reason is that we just don't have very good treatments for metastatic disease. If we can identify tumors when they're still confined to the local organ site, we can cut them out. And so where we detect early enough to have a surgical treatment, patients do very, very well. But once we've got diffusely metastatic disease, we just don't have therapies that are very effective. I'm going to skip this and go right on to this slide. This slide shows, I think, just how important it is to have good early detection. What this slide is looking at is the fraction of people who are alive 5 years after they're initially diagnosed with cancer. And it's shown for several organ sites: colorectal cancer, melanoma, cancer of the oral cavity, of the urinary bladder, and of the cervix. And these patients are divided into three groups. The group of patients in the light blue color, those are patients whose cancer was diagnosed when it was still confined to the local organ site, and surgical therapy was an option. And you can see that over 90%, I guess in this case it's just a little under 90, but for most of those patients, between 80 to 95% of them are still alive 5 years after their initial diagnosis. But if there had been a regional metastasis, or worse, a distant metastasis, you can see how much those 5-year survival rates drop. And so many people feel that the best approach to reducing the mortality of cancer is not to invest in better therapy. It is instead to invest in better diagnostic techniques to help identify people who have early disease when our currently available therapies are more effective. If we look at lung cancer is a terrible disease, has very high mortality. And the reason that the mortality is high is that we don't have any good ways of diagnosing it early. If we look in the United States, almost 100,000 men die every year of lung cancer, and almost 80,000 women die every year of lung cancer. And if we look at all lung cancer patients aggregated together, only 14% of them are still alive 5 years after they're initially diagnosed. And the reason is that only 15% of patients are diagnosed when the cancer is still confined to the lungs. Those patients we can treat, but the vast majority of people are not diagnosed until there's been widespread metastasis. The risk factors for lung cancer, the biggest one is smoking. If you actively smoke, you increase your risk of developing lung cancer by 13-fold. If you're exposed to secondhand smoke, that can increase your relative risk by 1.5 times. The signs and symptoms of lung cancer usually don't occur until the disease is fairly advanced. There's coughing, wheezing, difficulty breathing, recurrent pneumonia is another common sign of lung cancer. Because we have such a problem detecting lung cancer early, there's been a lot of effort devoted to trying to come up with better diagnostic techniques to identify patients with early lung cancer. None of them work very well. There are several that are in clinical trials. Just doing a chest x-ray, pretty simple technology. Problem with doing a chest x-ray is that there are a lot of spots that show up in the lungs that aren't cancer. And so we can see some lung cancers, not all early lung cancers, but we see a lot of other stuff that looks like lung cancer but isn't. Sputum cytology was another thing that people were very excited about. You basically hawk up some phlegm and smear it onto a slide, and then we're going to stain those cells and look for those, you know, that increase in the nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio. Problem with sputum cytology, again, is that there are just millions and millions of cells that are lining the airway. If you've got a tiny little lesion that's developing somewhere down in the bottom of the lung, the likelihood that you're going to sample a cell from that lesion in sputum is very low. I think if you could show with a chest x-ray that you could detect early lung cancer, that would probably be a very cost-effective intervention, would be my guess, because a chest x-ray is very inexpensive compared to treating someone who has advanced lung cancer. It's just a guess, but for example, mammography is a relatively cost-effective screening tool in older women. I think particularly if even in smokers, if you had something that worked because of the increased risk. You know, we've got a great way to identify who's more at risk of developing lung cancer. Other things that people are looking at is they're looking at something called spiral CT, which is another way to take a picture of the lungs. There are a number of multi-center clinical trials of spiral CT as a way to detect lung cancer early. What happens now is, we do bronchoscopically directed biopsy, and we'll learn more about endoscopy when we look at imaging for early cancer detection. But basically, they take a fiber optic probe, it has multiple fibers in it, and then they're going to put it into the airway and basically just travel to distant branches within the airway and look for visual changes and then biopsy those to determine whether or not there's a lesion there. The treatment of lung cancer, if it's localized, surgery is very effective. You had a question? Yes, they do. If there are indications for a patient to have a bronchoscopy, it's not done for screening. So it wouldn't be done just because, you know, I'm a smoker, I'm worried I might have lung cancer, but if someone has symptoms or a suspicious spot on a chest x-ray, yes. So there are a number of mutations that are associated with increased risk of the development of cancer. Smoking causes some of those, so there are environmental causes. There are also genetic factors that will put you at risk. If you have a particular mutation, it will put you more at risk, and then the combination of that genetic risk plus your environmental exposure is really what determines ultimately your risk of cancer development. We will look at some of those mutations when we look at the development of cervical cancer. It's an area where it's fairly well understood, and actually sort of interesting, cervical cancer actually in many ways you can think of as a sexually transmitted disease because it's infection with the human papillomavirus that causes some of the mutations that actually drive carcinogenesis of the cervix. In lung cancer, it's exposure to nicotine that drives much of that process. Although, you know, not all smokers develop lung cancer, and so we don't fully understand. But we will come back to that in Unit 3 when we look in more detail at cancer, and we'll look at some of the genomic approaches that are being used to help identify people who are at higher risk and who might benefit from some more invasive screening procedures. Maybe somebody who should have a mammogram starting at age 30 rather than starting at age 35. So, any other questions? For metastatic lung cancer, we do chemotherapy plus radiation therapy, but as I mentioned, it's much less effective when you have widely metastatic disease. So the last topic that I want to talk about is digestive diseases. This is the fourth leading killer in this age group in developed countries. 500,000 people, roughly, die in this age group every year as a result of digestive diseases. Cirrhosis of the liver causes about half of these deaths in this age group. So when we look at the liver actually is the largest organ in the body, and it plays two important roles. It's going to metabolize fat and glucose, and it's going to help remove toxic substances from the blood. And so if we look at the blood supply to the liver, there's both a supply of deoxygenated blood that comes to the liver from the hepatic portal vein and a supply of oxygenated blood that comes to the liver from the hepatic artery to help carry out the important detoxification functions that the liver performs. If you lose the function of your liver, you can't live without your liver. It will produce severe disease and ultimately it will produce death. If you look microscopically within the liver, the liver is organized into lobules. At the center of the lobule, there's a central vein, and that's going to be connected to an array of capillaries. So you have this radial organization of capillaries and veins that are lined by hepatocytes that will carry out the filtration function of the liver. In cirrhosis of the liver, what happens is the normal liver tissue is basically replaced by scar tissue. And this happens as a result of chronic injury over time. The two most common causes of cirrhosis, they're not the only causes, but the two most common causes are chronic alcoholism or a viral hepatitis infection. And over years, these can produce severe liver injury and can lead to death. The symptoms of cirrhosis are exhaustion. Patients are very, very tired. They don't want to eat. They have nausea. They can vomit blood. They'll have weight loss and abdominal pain. Because the liver produces important clotting factors, they can bruise or bleed very easily. And because they're losing this detoxification function, they can become very sensitive to medicines. Well, I thought I had a picture of cirrhosis of the liver, but I guess I didn't get a chance to put it in. But when you look at a liver that's been affected by cirrhosis, basically, the liver is it's a large organ. It can weigh as much as 3 pounds. And you can see that in severe cirrhosis of the liver, the liver is just largely replaced by scar tissue. And as a result, that patients die. So I want to do two more things before we quit. I want to take one last look at the leading causes of death by age group. So remember, we looked at childhood mortality, we looked at young adult mortality, and today we've looked at ages 45 to 59. And we've compared what happens in developing countries in the top row with what happens in developed countries. When we consider mortality, we leave out a little bit diseases that cause disability but don't cause death. And so another way to look at what diseases are really important throughout the world is instead of looking at leading causes of mortality, it's to look at leading causes of disability-adjusted years of life lost, or the DALY. And I know the font is a little bit small. I mainly want you to come back and take a look at this on your own.
Here what we've done is instead of ranking diseases according to their mortality rate, what we've done is we've ranked them according to how much loss of disability-free life they produce. And again, we've broken this out by age group, by ages 0 to 4, ages 15 to 44, and we've compared developing countries and developed countries. If you look at ages 0 to 4 in developing countries, many of the same things that cause mortality also cause loss of disability-free years of life. So pneumonia, diarrhea, low birth weight, malaria, birth asphyxia, and birth trauma. Here's some preventable diseases: measles, malnutrition, pertussis, HIV, and AIDS. Let's look at developed countries. In developed countries, diarrheal diseases, they weren't an important cause of mortality, but they do produce a lot of morbidity. Remember we said they're the second leading cause of trips to the ER in developed countries. If we look now at ages 15 to 44, now we're going to look at disability rather than mortality. So this is developing countries. HIV and AIDS, that was on our list of high mortality diseases, but now look, depression. Tuberculosis was on our list of high mortality, as was road traffic accidents. Violence, suicide, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, alcohol abuse, and hearing loss. Let's look now in developed countries. Depression, number one cause of loss of dollies. Alcohol use disorders, road traffic accidents, and suicide, they were on our list of mortality. Here's violence, bipolar disorder, drug abuse, schizophrenia. Here is ischemic heart disease showing up as number 9 on our list. And contrast that to cardiovascular disease showing up as number 2 in our causes of mortality. And here he is looking at ages 45 to 59. And again, you're going to see mental health disorders, depression, showing up on the list of leading causes of loss of disability-adjusted life years. Last thing I want to get to is a program called the Global Challenge, the Grand Challenges in Global Health. If we just take a look at how much money is being spent in the world to do research and development for healthcare technology, we see that from 1986 to 1992 to 1998 to 2001, there's been a very steady increase in expenditures devoted to healthcare research and development. And over the last about 7 or 8 years, a large fraction of that has gone into looking at problems of global health. And probably the single most important people behind that are Bill and Melinda Gates through the efforts of the Gates Foundation. They have committed since 1999 $6 billion to research to improve global health issues. And it's a staggering amount of money. It's the same as the budget of the World Health Organization over the same period of time. So I think it's a great example of individuals who can really change the landscape of public health throughout the world. Another important source of money, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, contributed $8.6 billion. This was launched in 2002. And then President Bush announced the President's Emergency Plan for HIV and AIDS Relief in 2004, devoting $15 billion to a number of different countries, many of them located in Africa. What are some of the challenges that these large organizations have faced in trying to devote such a large amount of resources to solve these problems? Well, as we heard when we heard about the update on the WHO 3x5 program, remember the guy who was talking about the program talked about some of the challenges of the countries just dealing with the procurement issues. How do you go from dollars to drugs when you don't have the infrastructure in place to purchase it and distribute it? So issues like that have been a problem. A shortage of trained healthcare workers. when Dr. Parkerson was talking about this area of 10,000 people in the Ministry of Health has put one LVN there to serve that entire region of people. This shortage is a big issue. Corruption has been an issue. And then we have many of these large programs that in some cases are not communicating effectively with one another. So a coherent approach to solving the problem some people feel is lacking. I'm going to let you read about the global challenges in healthcare, but I want to play this NPR story about the shortage of trained healthcare workers, because I think this is a very important problem. And then we'll quit right after this. Hopefully we'll hear it. There we go. Oh, you know what? We're not going to have time. We're over time. I will maybe start with this next time, because I know there's another class that needs to get in here. Sorry about that.